When you're responsible for, not always, but often for the talky bit, it's easy to start to feel like, I was driving in this morning, I was thinking about a different situation entirely, but it applies here, I think. Try to shorten this 40-minute long musing. The idea that came from it was that I wouldn't listen to an artist that only, a musical artist that only had one song. that'd wear thin, even if it was a pretty awesome song. And the idea that we would find our souls, our imaginations, and our lives filled by only always singing one song does not feel like a very tenable one to me. So when I get to be part of a conversation like we had this morning, that feels just so rich and life-giving and exciting and intriguing to me. That's what makes my heart beat faster. And it is in that space that I would wish to say a joyous Easter to you all. We have spent the past month talking about all sorts of different ways of picking things up and putting things down and doing that so that we will be reminded to pay attention to what matters most. And we have been reminded, among other things, of ways in which we are deeply connected to the earth, to this planet where we make worlds, to ways of being and doing that are filled with potential for good, certainly, also with potential for not good. And often as not, potential for that curious zone in between where we spend so much time. And so we've been exploring that, and we've done that largely in the sort of conscious framework of the season of Lent, this season of lengthening of days. In some ways, I would say all of that to say that in some ways, Easter, often in Christendom, often gets treated like a moment in Christian belief that operates as though that in-between space doesn't exist. And all of that in-between space sometimes around Easter just gets kind of temporarily overridden by Christians making a lot of noise about resurrection. I get that what I just said could sound disrespectful, and that's not my intent. Personally, I think that there are very few ideas that carry more powerful hope than the idea of resurrection. And think about it. What is more final in our human experience than death? What is more all or nothing than death? Death, from our human standpoint, is so final that, as I learned last week, many contemporary philosophers have decided that there's no sense fearing it at all, because being dead, we won't be here to experience it, so it becomes a non-event philosophically. But for anyone that has been in the room for the end of a life, or is looking down the barrel of a pending death, whether it's theirs or that of someone that they care about, anybody who's ever had any of those experiences knows that even if the idea that death is a non-event philosophically answers a philosophical problem, our lived experience says that death is a big deal. So resurrection, this thought that death is not the last word, is a powerful and an important one, and it's central to many people's experience of hope. Like so many important ideas, the powerful idea of resurrection can be subtly undermined if we treat it like an on-off switch. It's tempting though, right? Once dead, now alive. That's a provocative, moving idea, and it's an obvious pathway by which we might be helped to face the mystery of the end. And if we translate that way of thinking into a core spiritual idea, it can bring both all of that power with it, but it can also bring with it all of the attendant problems. And the Easter story, and especially the post-resurrection stories in the Gospels, offer us a number of narrative versions of human encounters with resurrection that more often than not take place in a different space than either or. They take place in a space that I am going to call liminal. Now, liminal is a word that we rarely use in everyday speech on its own. We often use it as part of other words. Subliminal is probably the most common instance, which is just two words, like so many of our English words, sub, which means underneath, and liminal, which means what? Well, it just so happens that I brought a definition with me. Because you know how much I love words, right? So there we go. This is liminal, as we would most commonly define it at this stage in our culture, our way of thinking. Two ideas relating to a transitional or initial stage of a process, or secondly, occupying a position at or on both sides of a boundary or threshold. In sociology, liminal experiences often refer to rituals, and the liminal moment in the ritual is when the person was, so a ritual that moves a person from one state to another, childhood to adulthood, not baptized to baptized in a religious setting perhaps, those kind of transitional rituals. The liminal state of a ritual is where you're in between the two, right? Where you're leaving one and going to the other, but you haven't left one and gone to the other. In the middle. So for our purposes this morning, the idea that I want to concentrate on is that second understanding, occupying a position at or on both sides of a boundary or threshold. And what I want to do is offer us several short stories about post-resurrection liminal moments, times when people in these stories seem to have a foot in more than one world, as it were, and where they find themselves occupying a position on both sides of a threshold. Now, a word about the art, which many of you have already sort of just leaned into, which is awesome. I'll explain what it is in more detail a little bit later. But for now, what I want to invite you to do is think of it in terms of liminality. I would invite you to look at what's in front of you on the table, if you're around the table, as a drawing of a both-and space. There's a bunch of oil pastels there. If you're not at a table, you're welcome to just get up and move so you can be a part of this part of the experience as well. You don't need to stay seated and facing forward. Basically, while I'm talking, you color. What I'm hoping for is that by the end, we will have any of us that are interested will have had a chance to sort of encounter an idea in a different way by making something of what's there. There are no rules about color here. There's no right or wrong ways to color those banners in. And in fact, there is no rule that says you have to color, just an invitation. I would, however, encourage everyone who is interested to take part, whether you're seated at a table or not, and the people at the table, I expect, will be gracious and let you in if you're not already seated there. Perhaps just by listening to the stories, but perhaps also by coloring when you feel like you want to in response to what you're hearing. It opens up a different part of our brain. And many of the things that we call spiritual experiences, in fact, can clearly be traced to things that are happening in our brain. Well, let's start, in terms of stories, let's start with the story of the liminal story of Mary Magdalene. This has got to be one of my favorite ever post-resurrection stories. And the version of it that I'm working from this morning is the version that John chooses to tell. So as John tells this story, what happens after Jesus has been crucified, has been murdered by the Romans, executed, just by way of remembering that the nature of Jesus' death was in fact an execution. I once heard somebody say that if Jesus had been killed under similar circumstances in the 21st century, all the Catholic children would be wearing electric chairs around their neck. Jesus didn't die on a religious symbol. Jesus died on a Roman execution device. Don't forget. All right. After Jesus is executed and buried, as John tells the story, Mary heads off to Jesus' tomb early the day after that burial, and she gets there, and the stone that covers the entry to that tomb has been removed. It's gone. And the tomb is empty. Mary freaks out. And she runs to find Peter and John to tell them that the body is gone. One of my favorite sort of little literary moments in the Gospel of John is when John's telling the story and he says, Mary goes to get Peter and the disciple that Jesus loved. Anyway, it's like, by the way, I wrote this. So anyway, she runs and gets Peter and John to tell them that the body's gone, it's been moved. And they all run back to the tomb together, and they look in, they see that the body is gone, and the cloths that it's been wrapped in, as are the tradition, burial tradition of the time, they're folded up and laying there, sort of maybe like somebody made their bed in the morning. And John says of this experience, masterful understatement, in the Gospel of John here, he says, they still did not understand. Yeah, thanks for summing up my spirituality. They still didn't understand. And I think that's probably a pretty mild description of the experience that they were having. But in any case, they head back home. But Mary, so Peter and John do that, but Mary stands there crying. And I don't know if you've had this experience. I have, and perhaps many of you have, of standing by a grave marker, crying. And what's going on inside of you is this profound sense that the person that you love, that you saw laid there, is somehow both there and not there. Maybe that's where you've had that experience. I've also had that experience with, you know, open caskets at funerals. I've had that experience being in the room when someone's physical life came to an end. It's like, huh, the you that was here a moment ago is still here, not here. I'm having trouble finding language for this experience. That space is liminal. Foot on either side of a threshold. More than one world at one time. And that's a space that intrigues us as human beings, but it also baffles us. Mary stays in that space for a while, crying. John doesn't say how long. Maybe in her grief, time wasn't behaving itself very well. That happens. I had a text on Monday from someone who had just been at a very difficult funeral, and they said in that text, they said, today seemed like it was 5 days long. At any rate, as we have the story, eventually, perhaps as she kind of gathers herself together a bit, she leans down to look in. And in John's version of the story, she sees two angels inside the tomb. And they, in what most surely be the one of the pinnacle surreal moments in an already deeply strange story, talk to her. And their question for her strikes me initially as rather obtuse and even insensitive. They are, after all, sitting in a tomb, and being angels and all, you might imagine that they know who the parties concerned are. But they ask her, why are you crying? See what I mean? And as though talking to angels was the business of everyday life, she answers them by expressing her sorrow over not knowing where Jesus' body has been taken. And then she turns around to head home. Like, just sit with that long enough to realize how strange a narrative that is. When she turns around to head home, she almost runs into a man that's standing behind her, who then asks her the same question. Why are you crying? And in my imagination, at this point in the story, there's a little grrrr inside of Mary. the question that goes with it is like something like, what is wrong with these men? Why can they not imagine why I am crying? A perennial question, perhaps. In any case, John tells us that Mary thinks that this man is the gardener. And so she asks him if maybe he's moved the body. To which Jesus replies by speaking her name. And at that point, she cries out in recognition. And there's this brief exchange between them. And then she runs back to tell the other followers of Jesus about the experience. And then they And then they what? And then they say, Mary, would you like to go on your own, or would you like us to drive you to the psych ward for a brief evaluation of your wellness of mind? This is a story to put you on tilt, right? Like, honestly. Is Mary experiencing a break with reality? What is going on here? Just take one moment and try to imagine any of this, as though you haven't heard it before. It is, as we might have said in a previous era, surpassing strange. But to my way of thinking, the least strange part of this whole story is that Mary should have mistaken Jesus, whom the writer of the Gospel of John has been calling the Son of God all along, for the gardener. That mistaken identity feels like the least strange part of this entire strange story to me. And from where I sit, that moment in the story could be understood as liminality, basically drawn with a black super wide Sharpie on stark white paper so we couldn't miss it, not unlike what's in front of you on the table. Why wouldn't Mary have mistaken Jesus for the gardener? Hasn't Jesus been standing in a liminal, a both and space, through this entire story? Hasn't this whole tale been one of God being so intertwined with humanity, dwelling so deeply within humanity that we've had conception, birth, life, and death all be experienced by both human and divine at the same time, over and over and over again throughout the entire story? Why wouldn't Jesus and the gardener be easily mistaken for one another? In a liminal space, where the characters in the narrative, like us, occupy a place in their world on both sides of a threshold, why not? Here's a couple of other short stories where liminality shows up in the post-resurrection narratives. Thomas, another one of my favorites. Thomas, who says that his paradigm for reality is grounded in the material, in what he can see and what he can touch, gets his mind blown and his perspective enlarged when 1 week after he said that John tells us that he said that, I believe what I can see, 1 week after that, John says that Thomas is in a room with a bunch of other freaked out disciples. They've got the door locked and Jesus joins them. So that's the angels in the tomb. That's the surpassing strange moment. Fine. What I want you to think about is the week. Thomas spent a week of his life. That's a long time. Thomas spent a week of his life surrounded by people that were saying of the world in which he was walking, eating, sleeping, living his life, there's more to this than you can see. Seven days. Standing on the threshold of a different worldview, struggling with whether reality can include both those things we test materially and those things we experience but cannot test that way. That's a lot of both and. That must have been quite a week. Peter. How in the world did Peter get to be the one that popular imagination has keeping tabs on the pearly gates anyway? Because Peter's big moments in the story are the ones where he loses control. Right? First of all, by trying to usher in a military revolution by taking a swipe at a soldier with his sword. What's a follower of an outspoken pacifist doing lugging his sword around anyways? But it's handy. And then swearing up a storm to convince the people around him that they should believe his claim that Jesus is someone that he doesn't know now and never has known. The high points of Peter's story. And it's on the heels of that denial that Jesus is led into this mock trial, tortured, executed by the Romans in a political bid to keep the peace in an occupied territory. And it's going to be several days before Peter, who was ashamed of his failure of character, gets to do anything even vaguely redemptive about it. That's a lot of both and. That's a lot of I believe, I don't believe. That's a lot of I'm not sure what I believe. That's a lot of Sundays at the kids' table going, how am I going to sum this up? And we could keep going, but I want to get to the liminality of the Jesus story and to what you've been coloring. The drawings that are on the table are both and. They're both symbolic and quite concrete. They are, for those of you who have been trying to figure them out, and some of our brains go there and some of them just accept that they're in front of us and dive right in, everything in between. But for those who've been kind of wondering what they are an artist's representation of the inside of the tomb. And I think the artist's statement will explain it better than I can. This statement, written by Hannah Garrity, the person who did the art, is written from the perspective of someone that would self-describe as a follower. She would describe herself as a contemporary disciple of Jesus. Hannah Garrity is both an accomplished art maker and also someone who's taken their theological training quite a long ways, well-trained theologian. This is how she describes the drawing. The inside of the tomb represents the struggle, pain, sin, and brokenness in the world. She says, I was drawn to portray how the struggle is all there, but is transformed by Jesus' resurrection. After Easter, the brokenness is still there. But as present-day disciples, we join Jesus to work to take it all away, knowing that God can conquer all brokenness, including death. The left and right images are from Jesus' point of view. On the left, we see through his eyes looking out of the tomb, seeing the path of new life that lies ahead. The right banner imagines that Jesus has climbed out of the tomb and is looking back into it, seeing the pain that remains in the world that must be transformed and eradicated with our help. That's Garrity's description of her perspective on the work. What she's describing could be understood as liminality, occupying a position at or on both sides of a threshold. We have such an enormous drive to certainty as a species that there's an entire fairly robust field of psychology that accounts for the things that perspective would label as illness by pointing to the ways in which the person who's struggling has experienced uncertainty. We don't like it. We're disinclined to it. We easily, in the sense of quickly, turn to making things that will make that feeling go away. Or if not go away, at least shut up. But when we're invited to explore the intersection of the human and divine, we are invited deep into something that we cannot be certain about, without also concluding that we are the divine in total, that we sum up the divine, which leaves some mystery, to be sure. And you can't actually own mystery without also being willing to own something other than certainty, without being willing to live in a liminal space, a both and space. the conversation we had this morning, that was just so delightful to me, could be understood as a conversation about among a bunch of folks who were taught, among other things, that what it means to be a believer was to know all the right answers and to be certain about them. And if we weren't certain, then to be certain that there was an answer and we just didn't know it yet. And that's what it means to be faithful, is to know those answers. And what it means to be a disciple, to walk in the way of Jesus, is to perpetuate, to propagate those answers. When you read the stories, like the ones I've touched on this morning, from the perspective of both and, it becomes a little different matter, doesn't it? Start to realize that the people who are trying to follow the way of Jesus, which is where the word Christian comes from, Christ ones, the people who were trying to follow the way that Christ showed, they didn't know a set of answers. They knew a compelling, mysterious encounter. And they made the rest up. And that's what we're still doing. And that's what we get to do. That's not bad news. Unless we think that the only way to believe is to be absolutely certain about a single set of answers and to live as though that's the only possible way to understand the story. I think we're invited into something so much bigger than that, so much wider than that, so much deeper than that. And sometimes it will confound us. Sometimes it will shatter us. Sometimes it will comfort us and embrace us. Sometimes we won't know what it is at all. That's because we're leaning into the divine. And the divine in us is cheering. I can appreciate your perspective, Ray, when you say that you'd like to kind of concentrate on the Jesus character. And frankly, I think that if we do that, our lives will be full. We'll have plenty to do. Having said that, I also appreciate that the core argument, as I would understand it, that Paul makes from trying to figure out his own encounter with the divine, is that the new home of the divine is the human person. And the unfolding understanding of the relationship between the divine and the human, Paul argues that the new home of the divine is not in a temple, portable, not in a temple permanent, not in a particular religious practice, which Jesus got himself killed for contending for, but in us. So we're walking around in liminality. Why wouldn't Mary mistake the gardener for Jesus? Why wouldn't Mary make the mistake that the divine and the human were standing right behind her and knew her name? Because it was true. Now, here's the rest of the story. When you turn around and somebody's standing behind you that you didn't know was there, and they speak to you, they encounter you in a way that feels like they just saw right through you. Guess what? That's the same experience. That's turning around and finding that the divine and the human were standing right beside you all the time. Now, there's a crazy way to go through the world, huh? I want to invite you to take a moment to imagine that God, or that for which we use God language, vigorously occupies what I've been calling liminality, the space in between the beautiful and the broken, the space where we have experiences that we can't explain or understand or turn into certitude. And I would invite you to think about an experience that you have had or are having. It could be a good one, it could be a profound one, it could be an ordinary one, it could be a struggle. But something in your life that feels like it occupies a space between, I'm gonna switch language just a little bit, between the broken and the beautiful. And the reason I'm switching that language is Tim and Jane are going to come and do a song for us in a moment that uses that language and that is just full of rich images of ordinary ways in which we both encounter that dilemma and live into it. Beautiful song. by Over the Rhine called All Over Ohio. And what I would invite you to do while we're doing that song, or in the moments just while we're getting it ready to go or going on beyond there, is if you think of an experience in your life like that, something that feels like it's in between that, broken and beautiful, it's not crystal clear either way, I would invite you, if you have an opportunity over the next part of our gathering where we'll sing a bit and then we're going to eat together, to, if you have a word or a symbol that represents that experience, it doesn't need to be explicit. Nobody needs to be able to read this and know what you're talking about, but I would invite you to put it onto the banner as well. And just to make a physical mark in the world that says to you, I'm having this experience. And as far as the banners go, while we're lunching and all of that, if you didn't have a chance to get in there and color a little bit, please feel free to do that and to add to what we are making together as a community all the time, not just when we're coloring. All right. Peace. Thanks for listening.